Welcome to Footsteps of the Fallen, a Great War podcast with me, battlefield researcher, historian and writer, Matt Dixon. For over 35 years, I've been visiting the cemeteries, memorials and battlefields of the First World War. And in this series of podcasts, I'd like to take you on a journey through France, Belgium and further afield and tell you the stories of some of the places I've visited and the stories of the men who lie as the dead of the Great War. So pack up your kit bag, pour yourself a cuppa, and join me as we walk the well-trodden paths on the battlefields, following in the footsteps of the fallen. It's a pleasure to have your company. So welcome to this first episode of Season 7 of Footsteps of the Fallen, and it's a real pleasure to be back behind the microphone again. I've enjoyed having a little break from the podcast, but I'm very excited to be back, and I'm looking forward to recording this new series of podcasts and got some interesting topics planned, and I'm hoping to have some interviews as part of our trench talk stories with some members of the military history community talking on various subjects. And I say it's very exciting to be back with you, and it's lovely to have your company again, whether you are one of our new listeners or our seasoned campaigners who've been waiting patiently for the closed season, as it were, to be over and the podcast to begin again. Either you are very welcome and it's lovely to have your company for the next hour or so as we continue our journey through the military history of the First World War. So I'm very excited that next weekend we'll see my first trip over to the battlefields this year. It's something I've been looking forward to, and have that draw that's pulling me back to the Western Front again. I'm heading off to my beloved Artois for the day. I'm going to go walking at Festubert, and one of the things that I've set myself the task on is seeing if I can positively identify the stand of the Scots Guards, the immortals of Festubert. I've been through countless documentary sources and war diaries and histories, and I think we've pretty much pinned it down at least to an area of a field by what was an orchard at the time, and looking forward to doing that. So I'm quite excited, actually. I've bought a drone, which I'm looking forward to taking out to get some aerial shots of the battlefield. I've spent many hours going through the French civil aviation websites because they've got very strict rules about where you can and can't fly a drone. I'm very fortunate, actually, that the vast majority of the battlefield at Festubert is actually in unrestricted flight zones. You can't fly anywhere near any buildings, but the battlefield itself is free flying, so it should be quite good to hopefully get some aerial views of some of the German strong points. So obviously, as they are now, very little to see as to what they were like at the time of the battle. And on the 16th of May, I've got the great privilege of being able to talk to the Great War Group about the Battle of Festubert. And for those of you who are members, I will look forward to hopefully having your company as we have a chat about the battle that probably is my greatest field of interest in the First World War. So where are we in this first journey through the footsteps of the fallen of Season 7? Well, we're going to head up to Belgium and go back to the late afternoon of the 22nd of April 1915, because what happened that afternoon, I say late in the afternoon, it was reported in war diaries that it was very quiet on that part of the battlefield, which was usually a sort of ominous sign that something was going to happen. And in the afternoon, members of what was a special unit of the German army opened the valves on more than 6,000 steel cylinders, which had been dug into the German front line trenches along their defensive perimeter just outside to the east of Ypres near the village of Langemark. And once these cylinders had been opened, within about 10 minutes, 160 tons of chlorine gas had been released out onto the battlefield, and it drifted over slowly across no man's land to the French trenches that were in this part of the salient opposite the Germans. And it engulfed all of these trenches that were downwind from where the gas had been released. And what happened was that these cylinders were filled with pressurized liquid chlorine, and they had been installed in the German trenches very much clandestinely. I don't think anyone knew that they were there. I think there was certainly intelligence that there was a possibility that the Germans might try and use gas, but I don't think anyone on the Allied side had any sort of specific information about when or where this might happen. And the cylinders had actually been in place in the German front line for almost 3 weeks. And the order to release the gas was entrusted to members of the German Military Meteorological Society, because the gas, as I say, when it was released, was entirely dependent on the wind direction. And the Meteorological Service had spent many weeks studying the prevailing wind conditions that usually occurred in this part of the Ypres battlefield. And what happened was that the French had actually received some intelligence about these strange cylinders that were being seen in the German front lines, and they were quite unprepared for the use of what really was this new and absolutely terrifying weapon of war. And when the Germans released the cloud of chlorine gas, it came really as a complete surprise to the French. And what happened was that it ruptured a 6-kilometer hole in the French line, and it caused absolute terror and absolute panic, I think, amongst the French and Algerian troops. And within sort of a few minutes of the gas having been released, this slow moving cloud of poisonous gas had killed somewhere in the region of about 900 to 1,000 French and Algerian soldiers, and had wounded approximately 3,000 to 4,000 more of them. And a British soldier who was in the salient at this time described what happened, described the sort of panic that set in amongst the troops who'd been victim of this gas attack. "I watched figures running wildly in confusion over the fields. Greenish-grey clouds swept down upon them, turning yellow as they travelled over the country, blasting everything they touched and shrivelling up the vegetation. Then there staggered into our midst French soldiers, blinded, coughing, chests heaving, faces an ugly purple colour, lips speechless with agony, and behind them in the gas-soaked trenches, we learned that they had left hundreds of dead and dying comrades." The German high command had sanctioned the use of gas, really, I think, in the hope that this weapon would bring about the decisive victory that they were sort of hoping for. And it was an idea, very much, I think, to try and break the stalemate of trench warfare. But it's interesting when you look at the German sort of perspective on this. I think really their faith in this sort of wonder weapon, I suppose, as they saw it, was actually kind of limited, because I think they were rather taken by surprise by actually how successful the attack was. And the issue was, it was one of those great missed opportunities of the First World War that I don't think they actually had any plan really to send a large offensive force in after the gas attack had been launched. And had they done so and sort of surged through this great big hole that they'd managed to blast in the Allied lines, then there's a very real possibility, I think, that Ypres would certainly have been in great danger. And in fact, could very well have fallen. But unfortunately, the Germans, or rather fortunately for the Allies, and unfortunately for them, they didn't really take advantage of the situation. And within days, thanks to some sort of heroic efforts by men of the Canadian army. The line had stabilised and both armies were back facing each other once again from the same lines pretty much that they'd been in before the gas attack had taken place. But it was a significant day, not just in the history of the First World War, but I think in the history of military actions in general, because it marked a real turning point in military history. And it is recognised that this was the first successful use of lethal chemical weapons on any battlefield in history. The First World War really represented a turning point in the way that the economy and the industrial forces of the belligerents were used. And there's certainly the Industrial Revolution at the turn of the century had really changed the face of Europe. But the forces that were behind this economic and this industrial change were also instrumental in creating many of the sort of technological innovations that were driving the war. Throughout the First World War, you saw the development of tanks and submarines and aircraft, and they undoubtedly sort of revolutionized how the First World War was fought, both on land but also at sea and in the air. And I think chemical weapons were really another sort of marvel, if that's the right word, of the First World War. And there, the way that they were researched and developed and deployed, I think really reflected very much the increased sophistication of scientific and engineering practice in the belligerent countries. And really at the same time that this was going on, doctors and medical researchers, and indeed some of these were involved in the development of these chemical weapons, were faced with a difficult situation, because what happened was that I think that they really sort of struggled to create adequate defensive systems and also medical procedures on how to limit casualties. And by the time that the armistice was signed on the 11th of November 1918, the use of chemical weapons in warfare, such as chlorine, phosgene, and mustard gas, had resulted in more than 1.3 million casualties and had caused somewhere in the region, it's estimated, of about 90,000 deaths. And whilst the use of chemical weapons was not necessarily new, and when I was look back through the history of warfare, there were very sort of primitive forms of chemical weapons were used. When I was look at the defense of castles, where boiling oil was used as a defensive measure to be tipped on top of soldiers, it wasn't really until the 20th century that scientists, engineers, and doctors could predictably, and I think more importantly, consistently produce weapons that were able to inflict mass casualties. And when one looks back at history, particularly towards the end of the 19th century, I think there was a real concern amongst European powers that they, about the potential for the development of chemical weapons. And it was such that they actually began to hold a series of conferences and began to write various sort of treaties that limited or certainly curtailed the development of this new type of technology. And I think really the problem was that Europe was a country very much divided. There was a great deal of mistrust and suspicion, I think, amongst the main belligerents of Europe. And it was really as a result of this, I think, that these treaties and these conferences were actually really of fairly limited usefulness. And I think that's something that very much continues to the present day and is no different nowadays to how it was in the lead up to the Great War. But the main treaty that dealt with the use of chemical weapons was the Hague Declaration, which was signed in 1899, and the Hague Convention of 1907. And what this did is it forbade the use of poison or poisonous weapons in warfare. But whilst having a document is one thing, in reality, when one looks at the statistics, one could argue that it was a fairly ineffective piece of legislation, because by the end of the First World War, over 124,000 tons of poison gas had been produced by the belligerent nations. The development of poison gas, like so many other new weapon systems that were created during the First World War, was very much an activity that was dependent on the work of both academic and industrial scientists, who found very much that their work was being kind of cajoled to serving the military needs of the government. And at the time of the First World War, Germany, I think, was arguably the world's leader in science at the time. And without question, it was the dominant force in academic and industrial chemistry. And they moved very, very decisively towards the research and production of chemical agents once the war began. And the man who was in charge of the German chemical weapons project was a man by the name of Fritz Haber, of whom we will hear more in due course. And he was a very eminent German chemist. He was in fact to go on and win the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for his work on fertilizers. But he led the German program of the development of chemical weapons. And he actually became known euphemistically as the father of chemical weapons. And he was a frequent traveler between the front lines of where the German army was based and his base at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physical Chemistry, which was located in Berlin. And he, as I say, was responsible for the organization and development of the German chemical warfare program. And what he did as part of this research was he solved an awful lot of the problems as to how they was going to be able to develop chemical agents in large quantities, but also how best they should be deployed. And there's no question, when one thinks about this and one looks at the research that he did, it was a sort of troubling, I think, precursor for what was to happen during the Second World War. And a lot of the discoveries that were made by Haber were to have disastrous consequences, particularly for the Jewish population during the Second World War. And this is something I say that we will look at later on in the podcast. And what one has to understand, and I think look at with the Germans' first use of gas, really, I think, mirrored their emphasis and kind of the German military doctrine on the offensive aspects of chemical weapons research. Because I think there was a real feeling amongst the Germans that technology was going to be the sort of the keystone to forming a decisive victory. And those of the Allies who were on the receiving end of these German chemical weapons, the British and the French, they moved first very much, I think, by looking at the kind of the defensive aspects of these new weapons. But what's happened as the war progressed, and by the end of the war, the national programs amongst the belligerent parties, the French and the British, focused really on the offensive and the defensive use of chemical weapons. And it's an interesting sort of paradigm shift that took place throughout the war. And the programs that these countries, the French and the British, used were quite often, I think, the result of a complete mobilization of their nation's academic, industrial, and economic resources for war. And let's say it's really interesting that you have these men who were working in these research programs in laboratories who found themselves being, I suppose, almost in a sense conscripted, if that's the right word, to deliver programs of research on behalf of the war effort. And one wonders, I think, very much what sort of ethical dilemmas and what ethical feelings that must have presented for these scientists. I'm sure the vast majority of whom felt that their research skills and their academic abilities would be far better used for good than for the development of effectively weapons of mass destruction. I don't know, and that's a supposition on my part, but I kind of see where there could be some ethical and moral dilemmas between the ethos of science and its use for the development of weapons of mass destruction to be used to kill as many of the enemy as possible on the battlefield. As the development of chemical weapons developed, the British government and the other belligerent nations brought in a sort of wide variety of specialists from the fields of chemistry and physics and engineering. And as the war progressed, increasingly they brought in experts from the fields of medicine and biology and physiology to help with these research programs. And I think what this probably did was almost sort of further blur the kind of ethical demarcations between medical and scientific research and military might. And just rather as they did during the Second World War with recruiting men from universities of mathematicians and statisticians, etc., to help in code breaking, so during the First World War, the British armed forces actually went round the academic institutions of the UK and they enlisted the sort of the greatest and brightest minds. They went to Oxford and Cambridge universities, the University College at London, the Army Medical College at Millbrook, and also the Lister Institute. And what they asked the scientists there to do was work on the development of gas warfare. And in fact, the French, when you look at the French government approach, they took an almost slightly more direct and perhaps a little more draconian approach to chemical weapons, because in fact what they did is they completely militarized the chemistry, pathology and physiology departments of 16 of the leading medical schools and institutes throughout France to take part in this program of development into chemical weapons. And it almost went as far, actually, it kind of absorbed the whole of the University of Paris into the military in order to direct and research all aspects of chemical warfare. Interestingly enough, the country that sort of seemingly paid the most attention to the developments of chemical warfare and the experiences of the British and French was a country that at that time wasn't involved in the war, and that was, of course, the United States. And what the government did at the time, I think they foresaw that there was a very strong likelihood that America would find itself involved in the war, and it developed a program of research into chemical weapons and chemical agents that could be used in combat, even though, as I said, at that time it wasn't part of the war. And a lot of the discoveries that were made as part of this American scientific research program were to have repercussions for the Allies and the British in particular. And as we'll see later on in this podcast, it related largely around the development of gas masks and effective weapons to combat gas attacks against soldiers. I think what's apparent was that there was a very much state of anxiety in the United States about the possible entry into the war. And there was a feeling, I think, that the military was very much unprepared. And what this prompted the United States government to do was to set up an agency specifically for the research and development of chemical weapons. And in fact, the origins of the American chemical weapons program actually came from the civilian sphere. There was a man by the name of Horace Manning, who was the director of the Bureau of Mining. And in February 1917, he approached the US government and offered the technical services of the mining agency to the military committee that was involved in researching chemical weapons. And when you think about it, it's actually quite a logical combination, because the Mining Bureau, of course, was very familiar with the research involving noxious gases and breathing apparatus and explosives and the technology involved to detect gas. So it seems a very good sort of mix of skill sets that they used. But it seems rather strange, perhaps, that the government didn't think to approach the Bureau directly. It took the intervention of a civilian to actually bring the idea some credence. I think the Americans were very foresighted in their approach to chemical weapons research. And rather like the British and the French, they enlisted the help of the greatest academic brains in the United States at the universities of Johns Hopkins and Harvard and Yale, as well as some of the industrial chemical producers that were prevalent in the United States. And they decided to set up a chemical warfare service, which was part of the military. And the research into these chemical weapons really began when the United States troops were actually preparing for combat. I think there was a real fear amongst the US military about gas attacks against members of the American forces. And what this did is it prompted, say, this huge research program in the United States, particularly focused on defensive measures. And they were given priority to the design of gas masks and gas mask design and gas mask production. And really, as the research program developed in the United States into chemical weapons, it wasn't focused solely on defensive technology. In fact, the Americans were responsible for the development of what was the conflict's only new chemical weapon. And this was an arsenic-based chemical that was very similar to mustard gas, which is a substance which we're going to talk much more in due course. And the substance was called lewisite. And now, this was created by a professor of chemistry by the name of Wilfred Lewis, and it was possibly the most deadly poison gas known to man. As we'll see later, mustard gas, which was introduced by the Germans, was something of a revolution in ways of killing men. But lewisite was a substance that was up to 30 times more deadly than mustard gas. And the Americans began to produce this gas, lewisite, in huge, huge quantities. And it was, the program was directed by a man called James Conant. Now, he was to go on to become the president of Harvard University and was a leading pharmaceutical chemist in the United States. And by the sort of spring of 1918, the research and development of gas and nerve agents had moved away from the Bureau of Mines, who, as we saw, were involved in the sort of development of the research program, and was given solely under the control of the US Army's Chemical Warfare Service. And it's a fascinating statistic that during the First World War, research into chemical warfare employed over 1,900 scientists and technicians. And it was actually, in fact, until the space program, the largest government-funded research program in American history. And it's reckoned that by the time the armistice was signed in 1918, that over 5,000 scientists and technicians from the various universities around the United States had actually been involved in this program. So it's a huge, huge project that they were involved in. As I say, some of the research that was done, particularly around the development of gas masks, was to have very significant effects for both the British and the French later in the war. As the war progressed, the development of chemical weapons became almost this sort of intellectual, I suppose I would almost say like a kind of chess match between the British, French and German military planners and scientists. It developed very, very quickly and new ideas were coming through. And what happened as the war progressed is that every time a new sort of offensive threat was developed, new defensive countermeasures were produced to fight against it. And really what happens when you look at the deployment of chemical weapons, in reality, the results that the chemical weapons programs had for the interested parties, for the belligerents, actually met with fairly sort of mixed results, because the tactics and strategies that I think that were employed by the armies were really struggling, I think, to fight against the challenges that were brought by the use of this new weapons. And I think there's far more significance to just the military. It prompted, I think, really almost a cultural change in the way that warfare was viewed through both Britain, France, and Germany. And it's interesting that the effect of gas sort of permeated down really into popular culture. And of course, one only has to think of war poetry, and possibly the most famous war poem written in the First World War, Dulce et Decorum Est, by Wilfred Owen. And he captures in verse really the sort of the horrors of this new form of warfare, where he says, "Gas, gas, quick, boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone was still yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man on fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning." What's very apparent is that the nature of gas attacks changed throughout the war, and what Wilfred Owen described in his poem of 1918 was probably very different to the gas attacks that took place at the beginning of the war when this weapon first started to be used. And the first major gas attack of the First World War occurred in what is now modern day Poland, and it took place at the village of Bolimar, which is just to the west of Warsaw. And we have an account that was written by a German general by the name of Max Hoffmann, and he was the commander of the German 9th Army. And on the 31st of January 1915, he climbed up to the top of the church tower in Bolimar, and he recorded witnessing what was to become the first major gas attack in history. And what the Germans did is they shelled Russian positions with about 18,000 gas shells, and each one of these gas shells was filled with a chemical that was called xylyl bromide, and this was what was called a lacrimatory agent. So it was a very early form of tear gas, and it was, as I say, the first use of this new weapon. But Hoffmann reported that he was actually very disappointed with the results, and he said in his diary, "I had expected much greater results from the employment of this ammunition in, as we then imagined, such large quantities. That the chief effect of the gas was destroyed by great cold was not known at that time." As we've seen, the Germans began their research into chemical weapons in 1914, and the programme, whilst run by Fritz Haber, really had its origins in the thinking of a chemist at the University of Berlin, another man who was to go on and win the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, and his name was Walther Nernst. And it was the research that was done at the University of Berlin that developed these first tear gas artillery shells that were used against the Russians. And obviously, as we've seen, that they were not particularly effective, because of course this was a science that was still very much at its early point. But by 1915, under the direction of Haber, scientists who were at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute had finally managed to develop an effective chlorine gas weapon. And what they did is that they placed chlorine into these pressurized cylinders, and what it meant that it could be discharged in this thick cloud, which is obviously exactly what happened at Ypres. And eventually what it would do is it would settle in trenches. And it's quite interesting when you look at the German approach to the, or the mindset that they had with this, that they really envisaged gas as a tool to draw soldiers out of their trenches, at which point they could then be dealt with by machine gun fire or artillery fire. And I think they saw it really that it wasn't necessarily going to be a lethal weapon. It was a weapon that was designed to really sort of harass the enemy. And in this spirit of kind of harassment, if that's the right word, the British also began to develop a range of non-lethal chemical weapons whose sole purpose really was to cause annoyance and irritation to enemy troops. And as a sort of response to the German use of chlorine, both the British and the French adopted a research project, and they developed what were called Annoyer grenades. And this was a type of grenade that had a small chemical charge inside it, usually tear gas. And they were used, as I say, just to cause an annoyance to the enemy. But they certainly weren't lethal, and not very many of them actually made it onto the battlefield. There is a passage in the Canadian military history of the Battle of Festubert at the 25th of May in 1915, where men of the Canadian contingent were armed with these Annoyer grenades, or gas grenades, which they did use reasonably effectively in attacking the German positions on the battlefield. But it really wasn't something, to say, that was done particularly commonly. And by the middle of 1915, both the Germans and the Allies had adopted this approach of using poison gas in cylinders. And this was, say, at this time of the fighting, was predominantly chlorine gas. But as things developed into 1916, both sides began to try mixing chlorine and phosgene together. And really the idea of this was to try and create a weapon that was even more destructive. And the use of gas in combinations was something that was engaged in quite freely by both sides. And as technology developed, the vast majority of gas stopped being delivered by cylinders. And in fact, it was delivered by artillery shells. And the way this worked was that the gas was in a liquid form, and this was sealed in a small glass bottle, which was inside the warhead, I suppose we would call it, or the fuse of the shell. And it would break on contact, and the liquid would then evaporate and then deliver gas to wherever it had landed. And the Germans developed a system of color coding for the shells, for the various elements that were inside them. And the German approach soon became adopted by both the British and the French as well. And shells were marked with a green cross if they contained a pulmonary agent, such as like chlorine or phosgene gas. Those shells that were designed to deliver tear gas, lacrimatory gases, had white crosses on them. Blue crosses had gases in them that were called mask breakers, and we'll talk about these slightly in more in due course. And this was gases like chloropicrin, and yellow crosses or gold crosses on the shell signified that it contained mustard gas. And the response by the British to the attack using chlorine up in the Ypres salient in April was met with absolute shock and horror around the world. In fact, one British soldier described it as the most fiendishly wicked thing I have ever seen. And the effect of this gas attack, I say, was quite remarkable. We have a document that was written by a man called Sergeant Ellington, and he was a sergeant in the London Regiment, and he recalled what he had seen with victims of a gas attack. And it's quite shocking reading, but I'm going to read what was written in his diary. "We trudged into the village exhausted. As we came to a ruined school at the edge of the village, lines of stretchers with wounded men were awaiting collection along both sides of the road. Propped against the wall of the school was a sight I have never forgotten, even some 80 years later. A group of gas victims awaiting who knows what treatment from the overstretched medical staff. Their skin was black, green and blue, their faces blistered and covered in weeping pustules. One man's tongue lolled out of his mouth with drops of blood and pus dripping onto the tattered front of his uniform. His uniform buttons that were once shiny and bright were discoloured and green. The man next to him was hacking up lumps of frothing green foamy tissue from his chest and tearing at the skin on his neck with his filthy fingernails. Several men were already dead, their faces contorted into horrific grimaces, their lips swollen and black. One man, going mad with pain, was trying to gouge his own eyes out with a rusty bayonet in a psychotic attempt to stop his eyes from hurting. In all my years of fighting, I saw sights that no man should ever see. I saw death and destruction daily, but the memory of those poor men who had breathed the devil's breath has haunted me more than any other memory I have of those four terrible years of war. It was this type of horrific suffering that really encouraged the French and the British to quickly develop some kind of protection from chlorine gas. And there's a famous story about the afternoon of the first gas attack where a Canadian officer who was rushing up towards the front had been a chemist in civilian life, and he detected the odour of chlorine on the air from obviously his knowledge from his academic studies. And he realised very quickly that the best way to deter chlorine was through the use of uric acid, of course, which can be found in urine. And this was prompted an order that men were to urinate on their handkerchiefs or whatever piece of cloth they could find and hold this urine-soaked cloth over their mouth and nose and breathe through this, because the uric acid crystallised chlorine and sort of lowered the effect of it. I mean, it's a highly unpleasant thing, but probably better than being gassed. And the British response to chlorine gas was the development of a very rudimentary gas mask, and this literally consisted of a piece of muslin which was tied over the nose and mouth and then around the back of the head in a bow, rather like a sort of surgical kind of mask. But unfortunately, these were very, very ineffective, and research into gas masks developed very, very quickly. And once the chemists had really ascertained that chlorine was the agent that was being used, they developed a cotton pad that was much, much thicker than a piece of muslin, and it was soaked in a chemical called thiosulfate. And what this did is it neutralized the chlorine gas to a point, but these had a very limited lifespan, and once they became saturated, they couldn't be used. And really, the development of gas masks progressed very, very quickly. And by the end of July 1915, the British Army Medical Corps had devised a new type of gas mask. And this was effectively a woolen hood that was pulled over the head and then tucked into the neck of the tunic. And it had a mica eyepiece in it, which enabled the wearer in theory to be able to see out. Of course, in reality, what happened was that as soon as somebody breathed, it just simply steamed up inside. And this hood was soaked in a combination of three chemicals. It was thiosulfate, sodium bicarbonate, and glycerin. And whilst these masks were certainly more effective than the kind of just the face mask that tied over, they were very, very difficult to put on, extremely uncomfortable for soldiers to wear. Soldiers often complained that wearing them was such torture that they would rip the hoods off just in their desperate sort of attempt to kind of get some fresh air. And the other problem was that the construction of them meant that they were very easily damaged. And as soon as they were damaged, this compromised the ability of them to combat chlorine gas. And British gas mask technology really progressed through into 1916, when the gas mask was replaced with what was called the small box respirator. And this was a gas mask that was attached to a box that was worn on the front of the soldier's uniform, with a rubberized hose that ran from a filter on the gas mask down into the box itself. And this was a bit of a technological innovation. It provided a really quite effective protection against poison gases, and it was effective against the vast majority of gases that the Germans used throughout the fighting. And the advantage of it really was that the technology could be developed as the gas threat changed. So whilst originally it was effective against chlorine and phosgene, it was developed by scientists throughout the war to be able to target gases such as mustard gas, which the Germans went on to use later in the war. The practice of putting gas masks on, what became known as gas mask drill, was really an essential part of trench life and was something that was dealt with an awful lot in sort of base camp and training before men went up into the line. And really, when you think about it, that for the infantryman, the ability to use your rifle drill is absolutely essential. And what happened was that the ability to quickly and safely put a gas mask on became almost as important a drill as the ability to, I suppose, use one's rifle properly. And soldiers were issued with instructions as part of their standing orders that they were to have their gas masks to hand no matter where they were or whatever they were doing. And there were various ways that gas alerts were sounded. It could be a whistle or the clanging of an alarm bell. And as soon as this was heard, what happened was there's the biggest frenzy of activity as soldiers began to put their masks or gas hoods on. And the problem was, I think, for the average soldier in the front line is that really, rather, instead of sort of viewing this as a tool that might potentially sort of save one's life, I think soldiers really felt almost perhaps emasculated, maybe is the right word, and certainly I think sort of very claustrophobic in them. And one British officer explained the following: "We gazed at each other like goggle-eyed imbecile frogs. The mask makes you feel only half a man. The air you breathe has been filtered of all of save a few chemical substances. A man doesn't live on what passes through the filter. He merely exists. He gets the mentality of a wide awake vegetable." And another soldier by the name of Albert Marshall wrote in his diary, "By the second lot, we've got gas masks which came right over your head. They were terribly hot and awful, but still, I suppose they did at least stop the gas." And one of the most important things or duties for soldiers in the front line was the ability to notify their comrades that a gas attack had happened. And gas alerts, as I say, were sounded in a variety of different ways. One quite often sees pictures from the trenches of an empty shell case, which is hanging on the wall of the trench. And it's then beaten like a gong to sort of sound a gas alert. And one of the other tools that was used was a gas rattle. And this was rather like one sort of sees at old video footages of football matches where supporters have rattles. And this was this wooden device that was kind of spun round, and it emitted this very loud rattling noise. And this was a sound to alert men that gas was present and that they should put their gas masks on. But they say that necessity is the mother of all invention. And there was a remarkable discovery was made by a man by the name of Paul Batch. Now, he was a chemist who was based over in the United States. And when he wasn't working as a professor of chemistry, he was an incredibly keen gardener. And what he discovered was that the common garden slug was actually a remarkably efficient way of detecting mustard gas. And what Batch had done is he took some slugs out of his garden and took them into the laboratory where he worked. And he discovered that when slugs detected mustard gas, they flattened their bodies down and they closed their breathing holes. And his research discovered that actually slugs were capable of detecting mustard gas in minute quantities. They could detect one particle per 12 million particles of air, which is about three times more efficient than humans. And this research actually prompted units to be issued with slugs that were kept in a little box in the front line, and men would keep their eye on them. And if the slug, say, sort of took on this physiological shape of flattening itself and clothing its breathing hole, it was an indication that mustard gas was coming and that men should put their gas masks on. one of the main challenges faced by soldiers is that whilst they were issued with a gas mask, there was absolutely no guarantee that the mask would actually work. And whilst the British and German masks were actually quite reliable because both armies had a very robust process of quality control, French masks were notoriously unreliable. And in fact, in 1916, the French stopped using them because they simply didn't work. But what the problem was that not only was gas a difficult weapon to deal with, it made treating wounded soldiers even more difficult because stretcher bearers and wounded men would often be required to put gas masks on. And in many cases, the gas mask actually caused more damage to the victims. And the problems of gas weren't simply restricted to the front because the nature of gas meant that it was dispersed by wind. And as well as affecting members of the military, gas clouds also caused civilian casualties because what happened was the wind would blow off the battlefield and it would carry gas behind the lines and into villages and towns that might be close to the front. And of course, unlike soldiers, civilians didn't necessarily have access to gas masks and certainly didn't have the training to use them effectively. And when you look at the official statistics, it's remarked on the Western Front about 5,000 civilians became victim of gas. Now, I think that's very low. I struggle to believe that, and I suspect it's probably much higher. But the risk of gas was so severe that the British Army Veterinary Service worked with the medical corps to develop gas masks for dogs and for horses and for pigeons that were involved in military operations, because obviously they could be affected by gas just as equally as their human counterparts. One of the biggest problems that was encountered by the medical services was that gas actually, whilst responsible, relatively speaking, for few casualties, it became an incredibly psychological weapon. And whilst one is familiar with the term of shell shock, of these multitudinous artillery bombardments that sent men's nerves into sort of free fall, the kind of this constant threat of being exposed to even a single gas shell really already added to what was an incredibly stressful place to be in the front line for a soldier. And I think the fear of being gassed, along with the sort of sporadic nature of gas attacks, it led soldiers to develop a condition that was called anomie. And this was basically a gas fright. And this caused, in many cases, actually mental breakdowns. And I think the reality is that soldiers on all sides felt really that gas warfare was not a proper sort of weapon, and it probably really went beyond the bounds of what civilized humans would deem to be acceptable. And a man called Harold Allen, who served in the front line, described the psychological effect of gas as follows. With men trained to believe that even a light sniff of gas might mean death, and with nerves highly strung by being shelled for long periods, and with the presence of not a few who had already been gassed, it is no wonder that the gas alarm went beyond all bounds. Gas horns would be honked, empty brass casings beaten, rifles emptied, and a mad cry would be taken up. For miles around, scared soldiers woke up in the midst of frightful pandemonium and put on their masks, only to hear a few minutes later the cry of "all safe." Two or three alarms a night were common. Gas shock was as frequent as shell shock. And there's an interesting passage that I found whilst I was researching this about the psychological consequences. And these psychological episodes weren't really just limited to the fear of the air that the soldiers were breathing. There was an after-action report from a unit of the Australian Army that's described an incident in which a platoon of machine gunners had become convinced that their food had been contaminated in a gas attack. And when a shell had exploded near to where the men were eating, the soldier remembered the following. Someone yelled gas and said their food had been gassed. All the men were seized with gas fright and a few minutes later made their way to the aid station. They came in a stooping posture, holding their abdomens and complaining of pains in the stomach, while their faces bore anxious, frightened expressions, and some had even vomited. And thankfully, when they were examined by the doctor, they were simply given bicarbonate of soda to sort of settle their stomachs. They were given a rest and were, I suppose, reassured to the best that the doctors were able to do that they hadn't been gassed, and they were eventually then sent back to the front. And the problem really arose not just from these psychological problems, but it created real issues for the medical services, because doctors and medics, I think, probably found it really quite difficult to diagnose what was real as opposed to imagined gas attacks. And I suppose in this effect, when you look at it, that the gas as a psychological weapon was actually remarkably effective, because when men had been poisoned with gas, for the most part, all the doctors, I suppose, really were able to do for them was to prescribe bed rest and wait and see if any symptoms were to emerge. And really, all medical staff could do was send men back to the front if they didn't have any sort of obvious symptoms of gas exposure. And I think really the fear factor as well comes because men who were wearing gas masks obviously had this situation where they didn't know if the mask was going to leak or whether the filter would run out and they'd find themselves exposed to gas. And really what happened was, I think the Allies' use of gas masks came to a situation where they kind of sort of stabilized, I suppose, in effect, the effectiveness of chlorine gas. But what happened, the Germans were pursuing this policy of innovation, and in spring of 1917 they unleashed a new weapon on Allied troops that made all previous chemical weapons really pale into insignificance, and that weapon was mustard gas. The development of mustard gas really corresponded to the change of the military doctrine on the Western Front employed by all sides, this idea of attrition. And what this really meant was that the ability to wound men instead of killing them often actually had real tactical advantage, because if you were able to continually remove large numbers of troops who were battle ready out of the forward areas, that really ultimately compromised the abilities of the armies to conduct their operations. And the problems with chlorine and phosgene gas came from the length of time that it took men to recover from them, because they caused respiratory damage. Men had spent quite a lot of periods of time in convalescent away from the front, and the average duration was 60 days for those men who'd been affected by chlorine and 45 days for those that had been affected by phosgene. So it was very effective, say, at sort of reducing manpower, and combined with the kind of the psychological effect of it, you can see why it worked so well. And while obviously these losses of men absolutely clearly impeded the ability to fight and launch offensive operations, really, by the time the war had gone into 1917, I think there were questions being asked really about the military effectiveness of gas attacks. And what the Germans did to sort of counteract this in July of 1917 is they released the first use, to say, of this new kind of wonder gas that was known as mustard gas. It was known euphemistically as the king of battle gases, and it had been developed at the University of Berlin in the chemistry department there. And eventually, mustard gas was to cause more chemical casualties than all of the other agents combined. And we have a record that was written by a man called Harold Gilchrist. Now, he was the medical director of the United States Army Gas Service, and he described the first mustard gas casualties as follows. At first, the troops didn't notice the gas and were not uncomfortable, but in the course of an hour or so, there was a marked inflammation of their eyes. They vomited and there was erythema of the skin. Later, there was severe blistering of the skin, especially where the uniform had been contaminated. And by the time the gas cases reached the casualty clearing station, the men were virtually blind and had to be led about, each man holding on to the man in front with an orderly in the lead. And the difference, really, with mustard gas compared to the respiratory gases of chlorine and phosgene was that mustard gas was what was called a vesicant. And this was an agent that caused large blisters on the skin of any area that it's contacted. And really what happened was that it became particularly severe when mustard gas was soaked into a man's uniform. And what would happen, they would discover that under his uniform, his skin was starting to blister. And it also caused very severe eye damage. And the other challenge really as well was not just the terrible sort of physical effects of it, but it required an entirely different medical approach. And caring for mustard gas victims differed very, very much from dealing with those who'd been subjected to chlorine and phosgene. Because once the men who'd been affected by chlorine had been evacuated, they were given oxygen and bed rest really until they were fit enough to be sent back to the front line. But the problem came with soldiers who'd been exposed to mustard gas, and particularly if they'd had mustard gas in a relatively high concentration, because what they needed to do is they needed to bathe or shower with hot soap and water. And what this did is it helped sort of wash the irritant off the skin. And what the army did to combat this is they developed these portable shower units that were staffed by specially trained members of the Royal Army Medical Corps. And what they did is it helped minimise the blistering effects of mustard gas. And these units basically consisted of a bath truck that had a hot water boiler attached on the outside of it and a number of sort of fold down shower heads. And what happened is the men would scrub themselves with a carbolic soap in an attempt to sort of get the residue off their skin, and the chemical units would then issue them with new uniforms as they swap their sort of contaminated uniforms out. And then these clothes, these uniforms that had been discarded, were then decontaminated, and then they were reissued to other soldiers. One of the real problems with mustard gas was because it contaminated entire areas, and the vesicant qualities of it often actually recontaminated soldiers in horses in areas that actually hadn't been exposed to mustard gas at all. And we have an account written by a man called Cecil Withers, who was a soldier in the British Army, and he remembered being exposed to mustard gas during a mortar attack, and he says as follows: "I suffer badly from phlegm and from coughs and colds a lot. That all started when the British were shelling hard at the last Battle of the Somme. One of the shells disturbed the residue of mustard gas that had been lying there for months. They talk about secondary smoking. I got secondary gas." And this really was a problem because mustard gas was actually heavier than air or water. And what it did is it settled in ditches and at the bottom of trenches. And it had the ability to go through liquid. So it would settle at the bottom of puddles and the bottom of shell holes. And all that needed to be done was that there was any form of disturbance in the water or in the ground or the soil, and it would reactivate the mustard gas, and they would then cause sort of gas exposure. And this obviously was a terrible problem, particularly with the amount of shelling that was going on. And it created real problems, not just for the soldiers, but once again for the medical personnel, because it was so volatile that a single soldier who had been subjected to mustard gas could actually contaminate an entire hospital ward of medical personnel and nurses, the ambulance, and indeed probably other patients as well. And this obviously was a very problematic situation. And what the medical corps did is they created a special evacuation system through the casualty chain to minimize this type of contamination once large quantities of mustard gas were being used in combat. And when you look at the statistics about mustard gas casualties. You can really see how effective it was as an offensive weapon. And although approximately, I think it's about 30% of all war casualties were victims of gas exposure, more than 80% of the, it reckoned about 186,000 British chemical casualties, over 30% of them were caused by exposure to mustard gas, and it had a death toll of around about sort of 3%. I think what's become apparent as we look at this subject is it's so sad to think really that warfare by poisoning soldiers had obviously been something that had been outlawed by the Hague Convention. But when you look at this story, there's a terribly sad irony in relation to Fritz Haber, the man who we've talked about as being the sort of the father of the German chemical weapons program. He was the German chemist, as we said, who invented phosgene gas and went on to create what was called the Haber process. And this was a process that allowed nitrogen to be fixed in fertilizer. And his development of fertilizer actually was a scientific development that ultimately saved millions of lives, because the fertilizer allowed people to grow crops successfully and feed themselves. And it was this discovery for which Haber was awarded the Nobel Prize. But the sad irony of the situation is that Haber was a German Jew, and he had converted to Christianity. And although he was dead long before the Holocaust began, he was one of the chemists who'd perfected the hydrocyanide-based insecticides Zyklon A and Zyklon B, the latter of which, of course, was used to kill millions of Jews, amongst which were many of Haber's relatives. You've been listening to an episode of Footsteps of the Fallen, the Great War podcast with me, battlefield researcher, historian and writer Matt Dixon. There are lots of ways to keep in touch with what we're up to. The first point of call is, of course, our website at footstepsofthefallen.com. You can find me on Twitter at footsteps_pod, or we're also on Instagram as footstepsblog. And if you are enjoying what you're listening to and would like to help support the podcast, there's a number of ways that you can do that. You can either support us via Patreon, where you can find us at Footsteps of the Fallen, or through Buy Me a Coffee, where you can find us as Footsteps Pod. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I will look forward to having your company in our next episode as we continue to walk through the footsteps of the fallen.